Okay. In any event, I just introduced you as having a private practice in Dover and Exeter, New Hampshire. I gave the callers your numbers so they can reach you. And before we get into our subject, Mary Jo, I just wanted to go through one brief technical issue. Callers, as you are probably aware, your toll-free call-in number is 877-497-9046. If you'd like to ask a question or make a comment, just dial 1 and you'll be in line to join us live on the air. This is a very compelling topic, so hopefully we'll hear from you callers. I know a lot of people can really relate to this issue. Anyway, Mary Jo, welcome to my Blog Talk Radio show.
Thank you for inviting me, Susan.
Oh, I'm very glad to have you. I've been really looking forward to this episode. This is such a compelling issue, weight and distorted body image. And so many people relate to this issue. So many people struggle with this. And I'm wondering, before we get into the issues themselves, if you could say something to our listeners about how you came to do this work. You know, what inspired you and what brought you to this line of work?
Sure. I've actually been working, specializing in this area for over 25 years. In graduate school, I had the opportunity to do some consulting work with the local high school in Missoula, Montana. And this was in the early 80s, and they were having trouble with eating disorders, and we didn't really know much about it. So I went on from there to do my dissertation work, actually with the high school students, and sort of developed my specialty in different ways after that, before I moved here to New England and came into private practice. But it it started in graduate school in the early 80s and continues to the present.
Yeah, so it was a perfect live laboratory for you, I would imagine.
Oh, it was. It really was, because, again, didn't know much about it. And, things have changed as far as what we do know. We know more now, and we can help people more, but not a lot has changed in the culture, except maybe going in an even more intensely negative direction.
Oh, so, absolutely.
So it's compelling culturally as well as just for me clinically.
Oh, absolutely. Hence the part of the name of the episode, Body Politics,
yeah.
An exploration of body politics. Now, I'm wondering, what do you see as the biggest issue for women in particular regarding their weight, and how do you see it as, well, either similar or different for men?
I guess I would have to give a two-prong answer there. In general, in the culture, the problem for women is many, many women, if not most women, feel compelled to lose weight and be thinner and focus on altering their body in a variety of ways to get that thinner look. And most of the women I know are on diets, losing weight, complaining about what they weigh. I think the problem, that's the more generic form, and when it goes into the more severe form of becoming an eating disorder, women then, of course, are complaining in a way that's markedly extreme, like having body image distortion, often losing, 20-25% of their ideal body weight, and still thinking they're fat, and literally seeing themselves as fat. So, the continuum starts with, I think, women in general in the culture and moves on to that, that clinical area, and those are the people I mostly see in my practice.
Mm-hmm. And they're getting younger and younger, aren't they?
Well, they are getting younger. I don't see young children anymore, but I used to see them as young as third and fourth grade when I ran a hospital eating disorder program in Chicago before I moved back here. We had kids as young as third and fourth grade. And, it's the whole gamut because there's a very interesting study about older women, I think over age 70, in a study asking about their health concerns with aging, and gaining weight was second only to memory loss in the fears they expressed about aging. So it starts very young, and it really doesn't end. It really, you know, continues to be a concern for women. And, you know, I see it as different from men, only in there's a little bit more room for men in the culture to be, to look a variety of different ways, to be small, to be thin, to be physically fit, or to be large. However, I have more men who I see in my practice now with eating disorders, and I think, you know, men are coming under more and more of the same kind of pressure, this mandate that we have in our culture to be thin. So I think, you know, it's that's changing quite a bit.
Yeah, you see and you hear about so many men who are addicted to pumping up and working out, and there's no mm-hmm. such thing as having enough muscularity. And
right.
where if they don't look like Arnold Schwarzenegger, they have you know, a very, very distorted sense of themselves as inadequate somehow physically.
Definitely.
So, yeah, and I'm wondering, do you see it in men more around muscularity and less around how much they actually weigh, the way, you know, and how much fat is on their body?
Well, no. I think because probably my sample of men that I see is a bit skewed. The men who are in the gym or working, you know, doing bodybuilding and using steroids or a variety of, you know, substances to help them do that aren't really looking for help. So, you know, they don't really come to therapy to say, I have a problem, until or if it becomes more of a clinical eating disorder. So I actually do see more men who have lost weight, who have body image distortion. I see men who have bulimia, and sometimes that has started with a sport, a participation in a sport or an appearance-focused kind of career, like, you know, modeling or something mm-hmm. focused on their body. So I don't see the bodybuilders or the muscularity thing in my practice as much.
Mm-hmm.
I really think it's because those men are not seeking the kind of help I have to offer. They're seeking trainers, and they want mm-hmm. the trainers.
Right.
You know, if they get in trouble with the substances or the addiction to the exercise or going too far, I think it's really trainers or maybe physicians in some
mm-hmm.
that they turn
yeah.
to.
Now,
so I'm not as up on that.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm wondering if it might be helpful for our listeners for you just to give a brief explanation. And I hadn't thought about this when I was thinking about the episode, but an kind of a definition or an explanation of how you would define an eating disorder. How would somebody know when they're getting beyond just a little concerned about how they look or how much they weigh or what size they are to having a full-fledged eating disorder?
Well, you know, they're all on the same spectrum as far as having some commonalities, and being dissatisfied with one's body is a hallmark of all the eating disorders: anorexia nervosa, bulimia, binge eating disorder, or any kind of exercise addiction.
Mm-hmm.
All have body dissatisfaction as a symptom. So when any behavior becomes excessive, whether it's weight loss, weight gain, you know, eating compulsively, using bulimia or using ways to purge food, when those things happen, it becomes more in the clinical area of an eating disorder. There are a lot of sort of quick and easy self-report inventories that people can, you know, look up and take, but I can give just a few thoughts that, you know, listeners might be interested in. If you're constantly thinking about food, weight, or body image,
mm-hmm.
that's a problem. By constantly, like, you know, pretty much all your waking hours and everything you do has an overlay of thinking about what you're going to eat, what you weigh, calories, how you look, how you're going to look after you eat. you know, that's a problem level. Having a difficulty concentrating because you're having these thoughts. People get into a lot of trouble in their relationships, in their jobs, in their schoolwork, because attention and concentration becomes pretty impaired when you're constantly obsessing about food and weight and how you look. So that's another kind of thing on the checklist, I guess. Counting calories, cutting fat completely out of your diet, experiencing guilt or shame around eating. And then more specifically, you know, with anorexia nervosa, people have lost, you know, at least they're 15% below what would be a normal kind of body weight for them. With bulimia, there is a purging, which could be through self-induced vomiting, abusing laxatives, or through excessive exercise. Those all qualify for bulimia. And binge eating disorder is, you know, overeating to the point where people really feel sick, don't make themselves sick, but really have a sense of being completely out of control with the food and cannot stop.
Mm-hmm.
So now, those are some of the things that come to mind, yeah.
Yeah, and it sounds like you're talking about a lot of ruminating about food and obsessing about calories, you know, is one of the two of the hallmarks of this. It sounds like traditional dieting, as we've known it, in many ways contributes to the obsessiveness and the problem.
Yes.
You know, we I think the culture would have us believe that diets like Weight Watchers or Jenny Craig or whatever would help us have a sense of the balance and what needs to, you know, come in intake and how much you need to exercise. It gives you a kind of frame for that. But it sounds like, with your description, that dieting just is another culprit in the problem. Or is there such a thing as, would you say there's such a thing as non-obsessive kind of dieting that may help this issue?
Let's see. Dieting is definitely a gateway for a serious eating disorder for many people who are vulnerable. And by that I mean that's where the psychological part comes in. Young people who don't have a strong sense of self, people who have other mental health issues, depression and anxiety, or trauma in their life. Hello?
Yeah, I'm with you.
Oh, trauma in their life that has led them to be vulnerable. I mean, dieting, as you probably know and anyone who's listening knows and I know, is weight loss is incredibly seductive. It's a very, very powerful feeling to get on the scale and know that because of what you've deprived yourself of or the amount of exercise you've done, you've lost X amount of pounds. To see the number go down is very seductive. For people who are psychiatrically or psychologically vulnerable, even if they have a weight that they've set as healthy or an amount of weight they want to lose, they get to the point where they say, well, just a few more pounds, just 5 more pounds. Keep losing, and there's sort of that point of no return where when you get into the eating disorder mindset, there literally are brain changes. The brain is starving, and the cognitive changes that go along with body distortion start happening. And, you know, I really think that the power of weight loss and the dieting is, I mean, I see it in my practice, that it's frequently kind of the portal or the gateway for people. That's how it started, even for kids, you know, whose parents have harped on them about their weight and taken them to Weight Watchers at pretty young ages and restricted them themselves or, you know, put them on particular diets at home. You know, I see them many years later where they've been struggling with a serious eating disorder for a long time. So the dieting industry is, you know, it's just a multi-billion dollar industry. So if it worked, if dieting worked, they wouldn't keep making billions of dollars. It just doesn't work for everyone. So I guess the last part of your question was, is there a healthy way that people diet? Well, of course, people lose a little weight and, you know, maybe gain it back or maintain it or take up a new exercise program. And I think there is a healthy way to diet and lose weight for health reasons. I just think that the people who are vulnerable to eating disorders get in real trouble with how powerful it feels.
Mm-hmm. And it becomes all or nothing. It's totally excessive.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it sounds like moderation here is the key, and
right.
Where it doesn't take over your life. You know, I just know from my own experience, I remember my teen and early 20 years always dieting, trying all different diets, and then finally,
mm-hmm.
And it was interesting because the image the frame that I used was I was battling weight. I mean, just that frame alone. Until at one point, and it was always 20 pounds. If only I could just lose 20 pounds. And I was in good company with everybody I knew. And and I remember at one point just deciding, it was probably at some point in my 40s, I'm sick of this. I'm never going to Weight Watchers again. I'm just going to just try to be moderate and exercise more and eat a little less and eat everything I like. And I don't know that I'm any heavier because of it. I'm probably thinner because of it and certainly much happier and less obsessive about it. But it's all around you. I mean, it's everywhere.
Oh, we're inundated with it. Yeah, it's especially now with so much connection and so much media, so much more media than we've ever had. I mean, there are some healthy images and healthy messages out there, but they pale in comparison to the dieting and weight loss and plastic surgery and just changing every aspect of how you look, you know, to be different and to be better. It sounds like in your case, you finally accepted the body that you have and decided to take care of the body you have without continuing to try to change it.
Yeah, it makes your life miserable. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think a lot of it also has to do with having some compassion for your body and for yourself instead of trying to beat your body into submission, into some ideal form that you aspire to. You know, really, and that's something that I know for me and for a lot of women, you know, women experience often when they have a child. They sometimes for the first time develop a kind of newfound respect for their body. They cannot believe what their body was able to do and how it took care of them. And it produced this child. And so, you know, I know for me it opened up that whole arena of self-compassion and respect for your body and how that factors into the whole issue.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. And I think people also, I mean, just staying on the body image, what control we have over it, I work with people a lot to try to expand their idea of beauty, to step outside the culture and observe different cultures, look at art, spend time in nature. You constantly remind yourself everyone has something beautiful. If you think about people you admire in life or in the world or in the past or that you read about, you know, in what ways are they beautiful? Expanding the idea of what's beautiful and trying to get away from what we're inundated with in the media, the way we're supposed to look, is really helpful for people, I think.
Oh, sure. I think we need more Renoirs and more Gauguins.
Definitely. More museums, less fewer diet programs, more museums.
Yeah, less runways. The one good news that I've heard is that, I don't know who it was, but there was some major modeling firm decided to raise their weight standard. I think they've been so criticized. Have you heard about this?
Well, I've heard about it, you know, going back to in Spain, the government actually got involved with saying that the modeling or anyone using models for any kind of media purposes, that they had to weigh a certain amount or there had to be a certain, you know, proportion of weight to height. And some other European countries have followed that, and I don't know if you're speaking of something that's happening in a particular agency, but there is a trend. The trend still is very, for very, very thin, but now that we have, Photoshop and all of that, they can make a body in a magazine look any way they want. So,
yeah.
In some ways, we're still getting the crazy images of what the ideal is, but it's not really the ideal because, unless you're 12 years old, no one looks like that. No woman looks like that.
Exactly, exactly.
Yes.
That's part
yes.
of the problem. The model
doesn't represent anything that's normal in our day-to-day
no.
life.
No, no. Now, I'm wondering if you see any particular family dynamics involved in body distortion and eating disorders and weight issues, and how you would see the roles of mothers and or fathers as problematic.
I do see families as very involved, usually in the business. Among my colleagues, we consider an eating disorder happening to a family if we're working with children, teens, or college age. There usually is a significant amount of, dysfunction, to use an old word, in families that have children with eating disorders. I think there used to be more focus on mother-daughter relationships.
Yeah.
And mothers having, a little more to do with not causing but contributing to, of course, their daughter's, ideals and ideas about what she should look like. However, more of the young people I see talk about their dads in therapy, talk about their relationships with their dads in therapy. And really there's a yearning for relationships with fathers that seems to be missing, that, when girls reach the age where they're developing into young women or they're developing sexually, there's a lot of pullback. A lot of dads don't feel really comfortable with that, those adolescent challenges or with what's mm-hmm. happening, with their daughters, so they kind of pull back and stop talking or become distant, and lots of girls talk about that. So in some ways it's shifted away from what's going on with moms to what's going on, between daughters and their dads. But with younger people, the families are always encouraged to be involved in treatment and therapy and, whatever is available for support, lots of education, lots of reading. The family dynamics, I can't pinpoint them. I see them at two ends of the pole. There are families who are very, very over-involved and controlling and intensely enmeshed with their kids. And
mm-hmm.
on the other end, there's parents who are pretty disengaged, families that really aren't connected emotionally and aren't there helping and guiding and, showing their daughters especially, how to navigate some of this difficult time of life. So, the family is definitely very much involved. It's not their fault that their daughters or sons get eating disorders, but there's a contribution that they can make to that, happening or even, to it not happening.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was wondering about that.
What they can do. Well, dads, when I talk to fathers, I really, really encourage them to get involved with complimenting and paying attention to and acknowledging their daughter's strengths and accomplishments that don't have to do with their physical appearance.
Mm-hmm.
We start telling little girls at pretty young ages, at very young ages, about how pretty they are and how cute they are. And, there's a lot of focus on physical appearance from a very early age. And dads especially need to be able to acknowledge the range of strengths and talents and specialness that their daughters have. It makes a big difference.
So they're not to objectify their daughter in any way.
Not to objectify. Yeah, not to be just focused on her being pretty, being a body, being mm-hmm. that young woman in a physical way. And it's exactly what dads are afraid of doing anyway, I think. You know, they don't know how to deal with their daughters becoming sexual creatures in an appropriate way. So I think there's a lot of joking about it sometimes, but it affects girls incredibly. It, in fact, affects them so much. And moms, you know, as far as you know, mothers being involved.
Mary Jo, excuse
yep.
me, you're breaking up a little. Have you changed your position in relation to the cell phone?
No, I'm in the same spot.
Oh, okay. All right.
The weather's funny here, so it could
yeah.
be just the connection. Sorry. Where,
yeah, that's okay. Technology
okay.
is very imperfect, obviously.
I know. Tell me if you need me to get up and walk around. I was just saying, as far as moms, you know, I mean, dads just getting involved in that way, acknowledging daughters' strengths other than the way they look. And moms, too, you know, eating disorders definitely run through generations. I see people whose mothers and grandmothers had eating disorders, often, you know, undiagnosed, but it's very clear to me that they learned a lot of the behaviors and attitudes for themselves and their bodies by watching the women in their family
mm-hmm.
and how they treat their bodies and also how they think of their own self-worth. You know, if
mm-hmm.
your mom's constantly going on a diet and saying, I'm fat, I need to lose weight, I don't look good in anything, I'm back at Weight Watchers again for the 25th time.
Mm, it bleeds through. Absolutely.
Definitely.
Yeah. So, and what about, and you might want to change your position a little because you're breaking up.
Okay.
I hate to make you walk around during
That's
the show.
That's right.
But,
no, I don't mind walking around.
What would you see as a supportive role for a spouse who has a partner who's showing some significant problems in this area?
I'm glad you asked that because I also wanted to let people know about and maybe we'll talk about this later and you can remind me about a book company that puts out a catalog that people can access that has all the eating disorder resource literature in it and including, you know, a section on relationships and what people could do to support a spouse. And there are many things, actually. First of all, making, you know, if someone's in recovery and they're getting some kind of treatment or maybe in a hospital program or, you know, whatever level of treatment they arrive at, making that partner's recovery your top priority.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely asking how she or he wants you to help and how he or she doesn't want you to help.
Mm-hmm.
Very important is being able to listen without judging.
Okay.
Or, you know, reading to get educated about what eating disorders are. You know, there's a lot of, not a lot, but there's some sort of misunderstanding and even joking about eating disorders in the media. And I think people have...
You're breaking up, Mary Jo.
Okay.
Can you change positions? Go to a different
yeah.
part of the room?
Yep. I can walk to another room. Are you what are you hearing?
Tell me when
you're hearing me. It's
that's
the weather
good.
I would hear.
That's
this
a little
good?
Bit better.
Okay.
Sorry.
Oh,
about
dear.
That.
Sorry.
But you're saying being non-judgment, participating, you know, really educating themselves, showing curiosity, being involved.
Yeah, being a supportive coach, you know, as far as once someone tells you how you can support her or him, do it. You know, be there and keep doing it. And not letting the, I guess, misinformation and even sometimes disrespectful kind of way that eating disorders are treated in the media and on, like, comedy shows, whatever, not letting that get in the way of really, really seeing the seriousness of these disorders. And no one gets through them alone. Like, people desperately need their life partners and family members to help them in just so many ways.
Yeah, I've worked with couples where it was clear that the spouse without the eating disorder would have so much anxiety about it that they became the food cop. And you see this with in alcoholic systems also, but where the that other spouse would be kind of watching whether their partner seemed like they were going off the wagon with food and getting excessive or getting more, looking more out of control. And they'd start making comments in an effort to be helpful, and mostly because of their own anxiety about, do you really need to eat that? I thought you were really trying to moderate, you know, stuff like that. And it always plays out, in my experience, as a pretty disastrous kind of role and a disastrous dynamic, because the ownership is in the wrong place for it. It sounds like what you're saying is that the person with the eating disorder or, you know, the distorted body image, the weight issues, is really needs to be able to take ownership for it and get support, not interruption, interference.
Absolutely. I agree with you. It does backfire when someone becomes the food police. With alcoholism, which you know is sort of a parallel, they have a good system set up. They know they have Al-Anon for people who are in relationships with alcoholics. So they have sort of an ongoing support for themselves, where I think, you know, couples or loved ones who are in families with someone with an eating disorder really don't have much support or much understanding from the culture, so they get feeling pretty alone and helpless about what to do. So that's where the food police stuff comes in, or what you were describing. And yeah, it is always disastrous because it's not about the food.
Yeah, that's right.
It's not about the food. It is about control or lack of control or self-esteem or depression,
right,
or histories of trauma and how you're not dealing with that, or, you know, it's about what's going on in your head, not what's going
right
on
and
in
the
your
food
mouth.
Is a symptom. The food is obviously what gets eaten or not or withheld is obviously a symptom of the problem. It's the byproduct. Now, I'm wondering, as you're a specialist in this arena, and I'm wondering if you could tell our listeners something about the type of treatments that you see as effective or not effective, and where medication fits in. And if before you start, if you could move to another area of your house.
Really?
You're taking a tour of your house here. Well, maybe if you go back to where you were in the beginning.
Okay, I'm going
to
walk
back to
the beginning. Other end. As far as treatment, why don't you let me know what you're hearing?
Okay, it's a little better.
A little better here. There's such a variety of treatment options depending on how, you know, severe an eating disorder is, or if someone's just at the stage where they have eating issues, or they're just doing all the obsessing mentally but don't really have the body symptoms or weight loss or any, you know, purging. The best and most recommended, and what I've found for many years to be the best way to approach these problems, is a good treatment plan involves a number of people. I don't just see people for therapy, although I think therapy is essential. Individual and group therapy is just a wonderful modality if people live in an area where they can access a group. It's a very helpful way to work on recovery. But I also refer people and work pretty closely with their medical providers and with dietitians, and sometimes with coaches or personal trainers if over-exercise is involved or if exercise is needed as part of... Can you hear me?
Yeah.
So I really work, you know, with a multidisciplinary kind of focus, and the research bears it out that people who do recover from eating disorders, including, you know, severe body image issues, are people who get the most treatment. So when people ask me, like, what are your success rates? And I say, well, if you keep coming to treatment, you'll get better.
Mm-hmm.
You'll be in that group of people who get better, which they kind of look at me like, well, that's funny, because they're expecting some percent number, but often it takes a long time. But,
mm-hmm.
you know, do the work and have that kind of support. Have several different professionals kind of in place to support different aspects of recovery. That's the best kind of treatment plan.
And where do you see medication fitting into treatment, or does it?
Well, it does. It does. I mean, I don't prescribe medication. As you know, I'm a psychologist, so I work with physicians and psychiatrists who do prescribe. I would say most of the people I see who have diagnosed eating disorders are on some sort of antidepressant or anti-anxiety mm-hmm. medication, because it so frequently goes along with these disorders.
Mm-hmm.
And it helps with working on the symptom piece
mm-hmm.
beyond medication. So it's a very frequent part of treatment.
Okay. Now, what's your opinion of a program, a self-help program like Overeaters Anonymous? I've known people who've gone, and whenever I think of it, I understand that it's the AA frame, you know, sort of calling on a higher power and admitting, that I'm powerless over this disease. But it has always seemed like a very shaming model. And I'm wondering what's your experience with that kind of a self-help group.
I think my opinion has changed a bit over the years. I used to be rabidly opposed to people with eating disorders being treated using that addiction model or that 12-step mm-hmm. model, because we have to live with food. It isn't a substance. It isn't alcohol or drugs. We have to have a relationship with food to live, just like we have to breathe air.
Mm-hmm.
I don't feel that the 12-step, which is based on abstinence, really can apply to food,
mm-hmm.
and abstain from food. However, being in the business so long, I have seen lots of people who use Overeaters Anonymous as a support group, you know,
mm-hmm.
as a support, especially people with binge eating. They use the structure of Overeaters Anonymous to have, like, a meal plan. They get sponsors and they have someone to call for support every
mm-hmm.
day. So in some ways I've softened a little, not so much about the abstinence, because I don't think it works with food, but just around people using what's available for resources. And there are not a lot of resources, and the ones that are available often cost a lot of money, and everyone doesn't have health insurance. So
mm-hmm.
now for people to use OA, I mean, my opinion of it, as you hear, is kind of mixed. Like, I think people with eating disorders, like anorexia, bulimia, can become worse. And,
mm-hmm.
yeah, there is a sense of giving up, you know, saying you have no power over your symptoms just kind of flies in the face of what I try to teach people and help people change in therapy.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't totally fit with my model, but I do try to be supportive of the fact that people get a lot of support and structure by using that kind
okay.
of group. So that's often.
Mm-hmm. Some people seem to relate to the fact that on that particular program, you know, like the OA diet, as I understand it, bans all sugar and all wheat. And so people seem to relate to the fact that, or at least they're taught there, that's kind of poison in their system, and that is part of the problem. And I don't know. I guess my skepticism about it is that it's still very focused on delegitimizing certain foods and the focus on the food and what you're actually eating or not eating, rather than... And maybe I'm ignorant about it. I've never been to an OA meeting. I've just heard about it. But it doesn't seem to focus on the deeper issues that drive the compulsivity around eating or the abstinence around eating.
They don't. They don't focus on the deeper issues for each individual involved. But, you know, the research about sugar in particular, you may be aware, or listeners may be aware, that sugar really is the culprit for a lot of people who have a problem stopping eating, that what sugar does biochemically in our body means that you require more and more sugar to keep it going. So, you know, they sort of treat it like a substance. But in the old days, there was a very rigid and strict, what was called the gray sheet, for anyone involved with Overeaters Anonymous. In fact, if you weren't abstinent from sugar and flour, you weren't allowed to speak at a meeting.
Really?
Right. So, you know, there's the shaming piece. But, you know, it's a different era, and I think that different groups, from what I hear, you know, from the people I work with, different groups stress different things, and that the eating plan doesn't have to be so rigid, and you can find groups that go, you know, along with this older, you know, no sugar, no flour, but that there are groups that don't do that and that they just focus on. But it is focused on the symptom and the food and what you're eating or not eating. I mean, there's some spirituality involved, and there's some support in just being with people who have your same kind of issues and problems.
Yeah. Yeah.
It isn't a place where people do a lot of individual exploration about what's underlying their relationship with food being so out of whack.
Yeah, I think one of the good changes with the Weight Watcher program is they're focusing less on what specifically you're eating and more on the cognitive and behavioral changes you're making in relation to food. And, you know, you're thinking about it and how you kind of take care of yourself or not around food. So, I've been heartened to see how they seem to be getting into the deeper kind of psychological issues that drive the whole thing. You know, it's very behaviorally based, and it seems to relate to it better. Now,
in the diet industry, it's the Cadillac.
Yeah.
You know, if I had to say that I, you know, approved of any kind of particular organized diet, I do think that they try to reflect more what's going on in the culture and in healthcare and in, you know, people's needs that are broader than just counting the calories and getting on the scale and what have you. They're definitely the best of the bunch.
Yeah, they've gotten away from the old model. I remember my mother was always on Weight Watchers, and I remember certain foods being illegal. And I remember as a kid thinking, what the heck is that? Why would a food be illegal? And I think one reason why people are so enamored with the point system is that you can eat whatever you want. It's just, you know, it gives you a sense of amounts. So if you want pizza, you can also have three ice cream sundaes for during the day. So, you know, I think it's getting away from delegitimizing, you know, it's gotten away from that. Now,
it definitely has, yeah.
Yeah. Now, for the average person who is obsessive about their weight and uncomfortable with their body, what would you recommend that they do on their own to make peace with themselves physically or correct some body distortion? I mean, obviously treatment can help, but other than eating healthfully and working out, which I see working out as correcting a lot of body distortion, but other than those things, what would you see the average person who's a little obsessive about it but maybe may not fall into the category of a full-scale eating disorder?
Yeah, well, going back to something I was saying earlier about, you know, fathers and daughters, just to broaden that, I encourage people to find things other than their appearance that are important in their life and to pursue them, you know, to pursue them with their free time and assess, you know, how much time do I spend on how I look and what I'm wearing and how many outfits I need to change into versus, gee, I have an extra hour today. I can take a walk in a park you know, before I go to work, or I can, get to the gym. I mean, the gym and certainly, you know, exercise is the answer for so many things. I mean, correcting body distortion is partly because of the, you know, the good brain chemicals that happen as a result of working out. So you're less depressed and you feel better. Your body's in better shape. And, you know, all of that helps correcting distortion, because the distortion is going on in kind of a depressive, clouded in, self-focused way of thinking, obsessed, you know, being obsessive. It's just mm-hmm. like all mm-hmm. about you, and it's all in your head, and it's going around and around and around. I also think people, you know, there are a lot of good self-help and workbooks and you know, reading material that people...
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. Any
access.
Reading?
Yeah, now I have to go back out into my other room, so I hope you don't lose me.
Okay.
I mean, one book that I've been recommending as a workbook for people who, I mean, some people just love to have, you know, paper and pencil and exercises, and there's a workbook that I've been using in my practice, but it's really for everyday life and people. It's called the Food and Feelings Workbook. Yeah, and it goes along with a book that you could read before or during it, which is called The Rules of Normal Eating, A Common Sense Approach for Dieters, Overeaters, Undereaters, Emotional Eaters, and everyone in between. Author is Karen Koenig, K-O-E-N-I-G. Both books are excellent. They're a resource that you could read and reread. You could pick a particular chapter that relates to you or, you know, something that's going on with you. I recommend those a lot.
Who wrote the Food and Feelings Workbook? Is it also Koenig?
She did. Karen Koenig, yep. She wrote The Rules of Normal Eating first, but the workbook I've been using more because it has just excellent... It's sort of like journaling with a coach
mm-hmm.
about how your feelings and how you manage your feelings in life and stressors and challenges, how
yeah.
that translates into the food. And it helps you look even at, like, where it began and some family roots and messages that you had as children. But it's just nice little exercises. So it's like not just sitting down with an empty page in a journal. It's sitting down
mm-hmm.
with some things you can write that's guided. So
that's great.
Yeah, and the catalog that I wanted to mention is it's an eating disorder resource catalog. And the woman actually who started the company many years ago was a recovered bulimic, and she and her husband started this, you know, catalog for resource books, and now they pretty much have everything that's published about not just eating disorders, but our relationship with food and, you know, family life and spouses, and it's all, you know, in sections where, again, people who go to what's relevant to their situation. Their website is bulimia.com.
Bulimia.com?
Yeah. And it's
okay.
called, the company is called Gurz Books, G-U-R-Z-E.
G-U-R-Z-E.
Z as in zebra. Yep, Gurz
yep.
Books. Excellent. It has lots of websites in the back that people can go for information. And it's all, you know, very high quality. There's lots of support on the internet. You have to be a little careful. The average, as you say, man, woman, or teenager, you have to be a little careful at where you arrive on the internet, because there are some not good websites out there that sort of support eating disorders. But this particular catalog, which you can order on their website, and they'll send you as many copies as you like,
okay.
has a number of good websites or online resources for support.
Okay. So the catalog is... It's written by Gurz Books, G-U-R-Z-E.
Yes.
And it's the website is...
Eating Disorders Resource Catalog is the name of it.
Oh, okay.
And their website is bulimia.com.
Okay, that's
great. It has every book in print regarding...
Wow, wonderful.
...disorders and recovery and, yeah.
That's excellent.
Really good. Yeah,
now, are you familiar with Jeanine Roth's writings about...
Yes.
I remember reading her in my probably in my 20s or 30s, and I always found her very helpful. First of all, she's hilariously funny.
Yes.
And what she worked with people to do was to get back in touch with the triggers to compulsive eating. Are you really hungry?
Mm-hmm.
What is your body telling you it needs? Is it a physiologic thing, or do you want a hug? And is the food going to give you a hug? And I remember years and years ago thinking, what a great frame for this. And I remember she would do experiments with people where she would take them to the supermarket. Are you familiar with her stuff?
Yes.
She'd take them to the supermarket and encourage, this was women at the time, women to buy whatever they really like and what they felt like they would probably want. And she helped people get in touch with all the restrictions and the taboos that they had internalized, you know, from their family or from the culture. And I remember thinking years ago, this was a great approach, because it got to what are the underlying emotional issues that trigger the eating.
Yeah, she's still doing a lot of really great work and writing, and her approach is terrific. I admire her very much. And, you know, I mean, women have been getting the message forever that they need to learn how to control their appetites in many, many ways. So, you know, that we're still dealing with this food obsession and body image obsession and diet obsession isn't surprising, because I mean, I'm leaving men out of this right now, but I know they're not completely outside of it, but women have been told forever that they need to control their themselves, you know, their appetites.
And yeah.
So Jeanine Roth speaks to that very, very eloquently.
Yeah.
In her ideas about helping women sort of break out of that and embrace and delight in their appetites.
Yeah.
Not be ashamed of them.
I know. Well, we're coming along, and
okay.
I think we've come a long way, and thanks to experts like you who really help get the information out and provide treatment. We are going to have to stop. I can't believe the hour is over.
I know. Well, we had a little trouble connecting technically at the beginning, so
yeah.
I'm glad we did get through, though, and it's been very nice having a chance to talk with you.
Oh, thank you so much for joining us, Mary Jo. It was very informative, and we have a number of listeners on the air who were probably very, you know, enwrapped kind of listening to what you were sharing with them. I'm sure it's been helpful to a number of people, and so I want to thank you for joining us. And
Okay. And
thanks to all our listeners for tuning in. Hopefully you enjoyed the show and you learned some new things about this very, very timely critical issue. If you want to contact Dr. Mary Jo Martin, she has an office in Dover, New Hampshire, at Exeter. And the Dover office is 603-742-1746. And the Exeter office is 603-772-3386. So thank you very much for joining us. And I hope everybody has a good summer. And my next episode will be Wednesday, July 11th at 8:30 p.m. I'll be announcing the topic and the guest. I haven't yet decided, but I will let you know. It's going to be at 8:30 next time, July 11th. So see you all in about a month. And thanks again, Mary Jo.
Thank you, Susan.
Okay, good night.
Bye-bye.